Flow with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Pavan. Welcome to the 59th episode of Robots. In today's show, we'll be talking about programmable matter with Jonas Nobert and Michael Tolley from Hod Lipson's lab at Cornell.
Their approach in making programmable matter presented at ICER is very different from anything seen in modular robotics so far. The idea is to put some building blocks in a sort of aquarium full of liquid, and flows in this liquid can be harnessed to stochastically assemble the blocks into any shape you want. But before we dive in, let's hear the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. Researchers at Tehran University in Iran have unveiled an adult-sized humanoid robot. The robot called Serena 2 has 22 degrees of freedom, weighs about 45 kilograms, and stands 1.45 meters tall. It was developed by the Center for Advanced Vehicles and the R&D Society of Iranian Industries and Mines, based on an earlier robot prototype. A video shows the robot walking in a slow but steady motion and balancing on one leg. According to the project's lead researcher, Agil Yousefi Koma, the goal of the project is to demonstrate to students and to the public the excitement of a career in engineering and to study both theoretical and experimental aspects of bipedal locomotion. The researchers are now planning to extend Serena 2's capabilities with speech and vision, improve its mobility and dexterity, and to give it a higher level of machine intelligence suitable for various industrial, medical, and household applications. The Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab has won a $34.5 million DARPA contract for human testing of a neural interface for a prosthetic arm. The arm, developed as part of DARPA's Revolutionizing Prosthetics 2009 program, offers 22 degrees of motion, including independent movement of each finger for the same weight as a natural limb. In this two-year project, the team will now develop and clinically test implantable microarrays to demonstrate dexterous manipulation through the patient's thoughts. In addition, the artificial limb will provide the patient with sensory feedback, restoring the sensation of touch. The results of this program are expected to help upper limb amputees and spinal cord injury patients, as well as others who have lost the ability to use their natural limbs through severe injuries or degenerative neurological disease. For videos of Iran's humanoid and more information on the neuroprosthetic limb, visit the Robots Forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Thanks, Christine. Programmable matter is an exciting emerging area that spans across multiple fields. Today we'll be looking at it from a robotics perspective with Jonas Nobert and Michael Tolley, both PhD students at Hod Lipson's lab at Cornell. They'll be presenting their approach to stochastically assemble modules of programmable matter in liquid from a control and hardware perspective. Some of these modules can autonomously solder to each other in liquid, activate valves, and communicate. Other modules have all the intelligence they need embedded directly into their shape. Let's see what Jonas and Mike have to say.
Hi, Jonas and Mike. Welcome to Robots.
Hi. Hi, Sabine.
Can you please present yourself to our listeners?
My name is Mike Tolley. I am a fifth-year PhD student here at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. And I am studying robotic self-assembly or robotic assembly of programmable matter. And my background is in mechanical engineering. I did my undergrad at McGill University in Montreal.
What about you, Jonas?
My name is Jonas Nobert. I'm also a grad student at Cornell. As Mike, I'm working in the computational synthesis lab together with Professor Hod Lipson. My time here has been a little shorter. I came here 2 years ago from a mechanical engineering degree at Imperial College London.
So first of all, I'd just like to say I really loved both your presentations at ICRA. And I wanted to jump right in by asking one of you, what is programmable matter?
So it is a word that needs some explanation when you hear it the first time. It's basically about matter that can be programmed, of course. So matter, we like to think about a bulk material, something where you have a lot of identical or almost identical pieces. So this could be sand, maybe, or little robotic modules, and that's what we're doing. And we can program them, and the programming is about programming physical properties. So something on the easy side of things would be programming the color of matter. And this has been done in liquid crystals, right? LCD displays, you can program the color into them and they change their appearance. But you can think about other things that you might want to program in a physical, in a tangible matter. For example, the shape or the hardness. And programmable matter is all about trying to program physical properties into materials. So there's different approaches to that. People try to do it in chemistry, and it's mostly called self-assembly there. People have visions about doing it with physical systems, basically programming atoms. And there's the science fiction author Will McCarthy, he calls this quantum wellstones, and that's a concept. And we approach programmable matter from the robotics view of things and try building little robotic modules that we can program.
What's your motivation in making programmable matter?
So as Jonas mentioned, there's a rich history in science fiction with this concept of programmable matter or something similar. For example, J. Storrs Hall looked at, called it utility fog, which was a bunch of robots that could come together and basically take on any shape and perform any task in the far future. But even in the sort of closer future, we anticipate being able to have big advantages such as versatility. For example, if you're doing a trip to another planet, say Mars, and you don't know exactly all the tools that you're going to need when you get there, you might want to bring along a couple of vats of this programmable matter. And then when you arrive, you can make them assemble or into any tool you want, essentially, to perform whatever function it is you need when you get there. There's other potential advantages, such as just as reusability. These days, more and more, the question of sort of green technology and reducing waste is becoming more and more important. And if we can make our devices from a bunch of regular pieces, if some of them get broken, you don't have to throw away the entire device. You can just replace the bits that are broken.
You guys have an awesome technique to make programmable matter, which involves fluid. Can you tell us more about that?
So we use stochastic assembly, we call it, and we do this in a fluid. So let's talk about the problem that one would usually have if you were doing it outside a fluid, just in air, and trying to do a programmable matter thing that maybe can self-assemble from its pieces. So you're basically fighting gravity a lot, so things need to, a new building block might have to attach at the top of an already existing structure. How do you get it there? How do you change the shape? Things have to fall off and attach to a different part of the structure that might be really awkward to reach. So that's how we came up with this idea of doing it in a fluid, where things just float around, and it's much easier to make things buoyant in a fluid than in air, obviously. And that's why we're doing it in a fluid, and that sort of causes it to be a stochastic process, because you can't really control how building blocks, for example, sand, if you're building a structure out of sand, float around in the fluid. It happens randomly. Things bump into each other, or they don't. And you can control, the flow inside a fluid chamber to some extent, but you can't really direct it as well as if you had your hand to use to build a Lego structure, for example. So our approach is that we have a fluidic chamber. It's essentially an aquarium, and we pour our programmable matter building blocks into there, and then we start building, and then we build a structure and from a pre-programmed shape.
So basically, you would like to be able to pull a screwdriver out of this aquarium.
Right. The idea would be able to pick any sort of tool or whatever it is you need, basically dump this sand in, and then pull out your, as you mentioned, let's say a screwdriver or a wrench, or perhaps something further down the line with more functionality, such as an iPhone, for example. But just to elaborate on what Jonas was saying, the idea of using fluid as our assembly medium is sort of inspired by nature, where within the cell you can think of all these sort of the proteins and all the building blocks of everything that creates life, essentially, is often just sort of floating around inside the cell, and we rely on sort of stochastic processes such as Brownian motion to move the bits around to where we need them. And that's kind of what inspires this work, because when you get to really small scales, it actually becomes quite difficult to pick things up and put them exactly where you want them with a robot, for example.
People who are making molecular motors, for example, they actually have a lot of trouble harnessing this Brownian motion, for example. And I'm wondering what the other main challenges are in making things assemble in stochastically and fluid.
Yes, certainly. The biggest challenge is figuring out how to harness this stochastic motion in such a way that you can achieve the assembly that you want. So a part of our work has been to look into simulation. We've developed a simulator that can look at various potential approaches that compensate for the fact that you don't know exactly where your pieces are going to be or when, but hopefully can still get, you can exert enough control, essentially, to get the final shape that you're looking for.
Okay, maybe let's dive into concrete examples with both your platforms. So let's start with Mike's setup. Tell us first what your setup looks like, the one you presented at ICRA.
Right, so essentially, in previous work, I've looked at assembly in two dimensions on the micro scale. So I made a set of 500 micron wide tiles and assembled them in a two-dimensional chamber. And this was all done without any sort of functionality on the components themselves. The entire assembly process is done by manipulating the fluid flow through this chamber. So there's a set of, if you can imagine, a set of channels coming into a central assembly location, and by controlling the direction of the flow through each of these channels, you can essentially move and manipulate all the pieces inside. And more recently, the work that I presented at ICRA was in three dimensions using the same concept, except on a slightly larger scale, because it's very difficult to do three dimensions in on the micro scale. And what I've demonstrated is the ability to attract these 3D cubes, essentially, that have latches on each side and fit together in any possible direction. And so you can imagine sort of an active surface where you can attract these cubes, bring them together, assemble them into the shape you want, and then release them back into the flow and sort of build up structures in this way.
What size are we talking about for the cubes?
The cubes that I'm working with right now are 1.5 centimeters on the side.
So can you help us understand how these flows work? Basically, they're like pipes where you put more liquid in it, or how do these valves work?
Right. So essentially, it's we have a pump with a sort of a fluidic circuit, and you can redirect the fluid such that it's either going, you can choose where it goes into the tank and where it comes out. And using this, so essentially you're creating a set of sources and sinks which attract cubes to various locations. And we do this assembly on a patterned substrate, we call it a substrate, such that the pattern of the assembly plane matches the pattern of the cubes. And when they come close together, they take advantage of sort of, this is an idea inspired by self-assembly approaches, where they lock into place.
How controlled is this? it's some sort of controlled turbulence, or is it really precise?
Yeah, I mean, essentially this is the main challenge with the stochastic approach is you really can't control everything. You have to have some sort of feedback to keep track of how the assembly process is going. So you can create a source at a certain location and expect that within a certain amount of time, eventually a cube will come close enough to get attached, but you can't say exactly how long that time will be.
How important is the shape?
The shape is very important, and you know, one of the key characteristics of our modules is that, as I mentioned, they can come together in any direction, in any possible orientation. So the pattern has to be such that each side will match with any other side of any other cube, and that's, you know, it definitely takes some trial and error to find the right shape.
And I guess you also need a mechanism so that if they're not exactly aligned, they'll slide into position or something like that?
Exactly, right. And on my cubes, I have latches, passive latches, that engage only when they're in the right alignment. If they're not correctly aligned, they're not going to snap together.
So this really goes in the direction of embodied AI.
Definitely, yeah. And you know, I'm a firm believer of the idea that, you know, as a mechanical engineer, the more of the intelligence that you can embed in the actual mechanical system, it's less that you have to worry about on the control side. And so that's definitely an advantage.
Tell us what you've been able to demonstrate with this so far.
We've been able to assemble reliably 3D structures, and we do this by assembling a planar shape, essentially, on this flat substrate, and then releasing it off the substrate and flipping it upright so you can add more modules on the side. Up until now, we've sort of been limited to a small number of modules, up to about 5, but certainly that's something I'm working on improving.
I saw a sort of little person in that aquarium at the end.
Right. This was a demonstration where we showed the ability to replace a piece from this humanoid shape that had been broken off. But full disclosure, the entire humanoid was not assembled from scratch.
So repairing is interesting, actually. Is that very different from assembly?
Right. So this kind of ties in the idea I mentioned earlier, which was the ability to reuse previous pieces of programmable matter, essentially. And so really, ideally, you want to be able to repair something that you've already assembled that has, you know, fallen apart, or there's a broken module, instead of throwing the whole thing away. So in the paper that I presented at ICRA, I demonstrated an example of this where you can put something that you've already assembled back into this tank and add on a new piece, and that worked out pretty well.
Can you detach?
Certainly they detach, although in my system I haven't developed. That's not something I've worked on a good procedure for doing. However, Jonas, who will tell you about his setup in a minute, has looked at a process that is much more easily reversible for attaching and detaching modules.
I'm thinking it would be awesome to shake this aquarium and sort of be able to start over.
Right. Yeah, that's certainly a good idea that I haven't thought about trying, so I'll give that a go.
So just one final question. What are the future steps in your specific project?
So really what the ultimate goal is to be able to do this on a small scale. If we can figure out a way to assemble these cubes in 3 dimensions at, say, the 500 micron scale, it would be a really nice demonstration of small-scale 3D assembly. And as opposed to the approach that you're going to hear about in a moment from Jonas, as I mentioned, because there's no, the modules themselves are very simple, so this might be a nice stepping stone to making more complex pieces of programmable matter.
Okay, let's look at Jonas's setup. Well, go ahead, tell us what it's all about.
So my system is similar to Mike's in that it's also with a fluidic chamber. It's also about cubes, so my modules are of cube shape. What my system adds is that the cubes are active. So when they are supplied with power, they can do a computation, and various other things. And that, of course, implies that there's a little microprocessor in there and various electronics. Other things that are added are all with the idea of extending the substrate that Mike's been talking about. So in Mike's system, most of the assembly really happens at the bottom of the fluidic chamber on this substrate to which the cubes can dock. So the idea in my system is that with every cube that has been assembled, so for example, the first one being assembled to the bottom of the fluidic tank, we extend the surface, the substrate, to the entire shape, the entire outside surface of the already assembled structure. And to do that, we need active cubes that resemble the substrate on the outside. In the assembly process, that would happen in my chamber. The first cube gets attracted to the substrate, and it looks on its outside just like the substrate, and any other cube can now be attracted to the substrate or the already assembled cube. And this way, the structure can, in theory, grow a lot taller, bigger in various dimensions than this is the case in Mike's system.
I must say, when I saw your talk, I was pretty amazed by the hardware. Being a software person, I'm always amazed by hardware, but in your case, it was really special. So can you go into the nitty-gritty of what these cubes have as functionalities?
Sure. So you're referring to my ICRA talk, and there I really presented two of the main technical components that are required and that we've pretty much solved now to make the system I just described work. I should say, however, that we haven't really integrated everything yet. We're not at the stage where we have the aquarium set up and are building little spaceship or structures or screwdrivers in there yet. So the question is, what's needed to make a structure grow by itself? And everyone who's doing modular robotics knows for sure that attachment of modules is a problem that needs to be solved with every system, and that's one of the things that we needed to take care of, with the added challenge that this happens in a fluid, that it's happening without human intervention. There's no human putting things together. So this is point number one in terms of the hardware innovations here. Is we built this new method of sticking modules, the little cubes, together, and instead of using magnetics that's frequently used or latches, which are also very common, and Mike's using them, we decided to basically just solder the robotic modules together, because what we need is a mechanical bond that needs to be strong and reversible, but we also need an electrical bond to pass information and energy from one module to another. So what we're doing is every cube on the outside, the faces are basically just circuit boards that have rather large metal pads exposed to the outside of the cube, and we coat these with a low melting point alloy, which melts at about 60 Celsius, and that's about the temperature of your cup of coffee. So we can just heat them with a little resistor that's mounted underneath on the same circuit board. The low melting point metal melts, and if there's an adjacent cube, they're effectively soldered together. And if you give it some time for cooling, what you have is two or more cubes attached to each other with a really, really strong bond. Really, the bond doesn't break at all. Rather, our cube modules break first. You can build a very strong structure, and you can pass energy from one to another. So that's number one of the things that needed to be solved to make this happen. The second thing is pretty specific to our fluidic system, in that we need to attract new modules to certain spaces on the substrate or on the cube, on the shape's outer surface. And to do that, we have to have we have fluidic channels inside the structure, and therefore inside every one of the modules. So if you picture our cube, it's basically got a hole on every of its six faces, and they're connected in the middle. And if you stick many of them together, you have a big, big plumbing system, essentially. And what we're doing is we suck flow out of the bottom of our aquarium through the substrate. And once cubes attached to the substrate, this flow is also directed through the structure, which we already have. And thereby, we basically suck water out into the assembled structure. Now, we need to control this in some way, because otherwise we cannot selectively attract new modules. And to do this, we need little valves inside our modules. And this has really been the other big challenge of this project that I've been spending many, many months on. And the solution I presented at ICRA is using a special fluid for that. So instead of building a complex mechanical valve, we outsourced the valving to the fluid. And we did that by using something that's called a thermorheological fluid. So this is just like water, and we pour some powder in to give it some magic properties, if you want. And that is that when you heat it, it turns into a gel. So at room temperature, you have water that's pretty much like normal water. You probably just shouldn't drink it. And when you heat it, just a little bit, and you can do that with resistors or coils or things like that, anything that turns hot, really, it turns into a gel and blocks the channel adjacent to your heater. And basically, we're using the system to build six valves into a little module that's got approximately 25 millimeters length on each side. So it's a very small cube with intelligence, the connector on either side using the low melting point metal, and six valves inside.
Is there any conflict between the valves and soldering?
Sure, that's a problem we've had to deal with, and turns out not so much, because if you're working in the fluid, the heat gets moved away very fast. Most fluids are very good heat conductors, much better than air. So when I first tested the bonding method, for example, in air, it was very easy to get the low melting point alloy to melt. It, you know, matter of a second maybe. But then I put it into water, and you're using deionized water for that, by the way, because otherwise you get a lot of short circuits. And it didn't work anymore. So there are various heat transfer problems to be solved in here.
You mentioned short circuits before. Are there any other challenges for making hardware that go into liquid?
Sure, there are lots of challenges putting electronics in particular go underwater. So as I said, you can't do it with normal water because that's conductive, and you really can't do it with any conductive liquid because that would destroy any electric functionality. You would not be able to have any communication in your structure, the whole programming idea of programmable matter would essentially break down. So the first thing you have to do if you build a system like this is find a suitable fluid. And the deionized water does pretty well. When we did the test, we made prototypes of all the circuit boards, programmed them to do some trivial task, and threw them into a beaker and looked what happened. Turns out that everything works, with the exception of the microcontroller, which still does its job, but it does it very slowly. So it seems like the timing goes off, and if anyone can explain that to me, I'd be very interested in why this is the case. Our pretty easy solution was to just cover all the sensitive parts of the electronic with epoxy so that the water can't get near them. And with that, the short circuit problem is solved. I mentioned the heat transfer problem. Different fluids transfer heat in different ways. We figured out that cooking oil is a great fluid to work with the exception of the funny smell that you carry around all day if you have to work with it, because it doesn't transfer heat as much. Then again, you can't make cooking oil thermorheological. So there's a lot of trade-offs to look at in selecting fluids and what electronics to use for this kind of underwater system. And it really depends on the exact application that you have in mind, and you really have to work with material properties here.
You mentioned that you can direct the cubes using these flows. Are you actually looking at control right now already?
So as I said, we've built all the parts, and the integration is what I'm currently working on. So in my system, I'm definitely not having this the fluidic problem solved. Mike has done this to some extent with his system, where he can basically direct cubes to any given place on the substrate. And of course, this is it's stochastic, so it doesn't always work, but you can always repeat it. We are also working in collaboration with Professor Erickson here at Cornell, who is a fluidics specialist, and his group has been doing some work on giving us a better understanding as to what we have to do in our aquarium to direct cubes to come to a certain place. So, as I mentioned, we're the one guiding thing that we use is we guide cubes to the structure by sucking flow into the structure, basically. And that's pretty good for the near field, let's call it acquisition of new cubes. Of course, you need some stirring, and there's a lot of fluidics questions that need to be solved for that, and we're definitely not at the point where we've solved all of them.
You mentioned some intelligence in these cubes. They all have a microprocessor. How do you actually give commands to these microprocessors? Are you imagining a distributed algorithm or really a central planner?
It's a question that comes up a lot, and the answer that I like to give to that is that lots and lots of people have thought about various algorithms for these self-assembly tasks. And if you look through the literature, you just need to look at the conference proceedings of, you know, one conference like ICRA, and you'll find tens, if not hundreds, of papers that deal with this problem. So we don't spend too much time investigating this because, you know, simulating an algorithm is one thing, building it and making it work in a real system is another, and we're really focusing on this implementation right now. But I can tell you what we have in mind and in terms of the algorithm that we'll use to start with and that we're currently testing. So currently we have this master-slave system in mind where really the base is giving instructions to the different cubes on what to do. And, you know, you might argue that defeats the purpose of programmable matter if you need a big computer in the base to direct anything. But it wouldn't be too difficult to imagine just getting rid of this one big computer at a later point in time and having the main computation done in the modules. What I think is much more interesting is how the communication between modules work. And normal modular robotic systems usually have some complicated communications bus implemented, and that's something that just doesn't work for us because underwater, you know, you have losses in the communication. You have to go pretty slow to accommodate for, you know, processors that are immersed in water, where the timing might be slightly off, things like that. So we opted for the most basic communication bus that you can think of, and it's basically just a ground and a communication pin, and every cube is connected to every other. So if one cube talks, everyone else has to listen. That might sound like a bad implementation, but if you think about it, of this case of, you know, you have any random arrangement of cubes immersed in water, that's actually it's actually the only thing you can do unless you want to go for bigger modules and move away from this whole idea of having, you know, programmable sand in an aquarium.
If I can sort of add something to what Jonas was saying about the about controlling these cubes, I think our ultimate goal is to have all the pieces be able to sort of figure out what they have to do to be come to find the right place in the final structure. But as a sort of stepping stone, as an intermediate step, we have a central processor. And one of the advantages, or sort of one of the characteristics of a fluidic system, is that the fluid flow is actually always going to be slower than whatever processing you have. So really the processing power isn't the limiting factor at this point.
Do you think the algorithms you're developing for your larger cubes can be applied, for example, in Genesis system?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I've also actually done some simulation work targeted specifically at the system that Jonas is developing, and figuring out how to guarantee that you're going to end up with the structure that you want without any errors. So one of the problems with this system is if you follow a sort of straightforward assembly approach, you might think just add cubes where they're needed. It turns out it's actually really easy to leave holes behind that you can't fill. And so we have a paper going through the review process right now that looks at this problem of how do you identify the places you can add cubes without leading to any of these errors in the future. And the approach that we take is sort of the opposite of what you might think. Instead of starting with the first cube and figuring out where you can put it, we look at the completed structure and pull one piece off at a time to find valid assembly paths that way. So if you can imagine a puzzle, it's a lot easier to pull a puzzle apart than to figure out how to put it together, right? So that's kind of one idea that we're taking to finding paths to assembly.
I remember some work by Daniel LaRusse on a similar approach.
Right. Daniel LaRusse's group has developed a system called Mish. And so this system, the way it works is the entire robot actually begins with a volume or a block of cubes. And then they decide, instead of deciding which ones where to add cubes on, they release the ones that aren't needed. So they kind of chisel away the structure from this block. So the control algorithm that I was just describing follows this approach, but virtually, in order to figure out the assembly process, which we do, you know, starting from the ground up.
Okay. To wrap up, I'd like to look a bit into the future and ask you guys what you think will happen in the area of programmable matter.
So this is that's a wide question to answer because there's so many different approaches. As I mentioned, there's people, you know, biologists, chemists, physicists working on this, and it's really hard to say what they're doing. We can really only speak for the robotic aspect of programmable matter, and I think here. The main development that's really needed to move this forward is solving scalability issues. So we have the size scalability. Modules need to be smaller to find any sensible application, I think. The other thing is number of modules. If I'm correct, the largest number of modules in any modular robot that do something together is currently at 56. And that's just not enough. If you want to have programmable matter applications where you really program 3D shapes and do something with them, tens won't do the job. You probably need hundreds, if not thousands, and ideally millions of modules that work together. And I think it's still a lot of work to do to make this happen, but I'm pretty sure it will happen at some point.
Looking at the big picture, what I would add is that I think we have, engineers have developed many very clever fabrication processes for making all the day-to-day devices that we use, and I don't think programmable matter is ever going to overtake the sort of the mass production of, say, a computer when everyone wants the exact same thing. But I think what we're going to see more and more in the future and what we're already starting to see is mass customization. So it turns out there are actually a lot of products and a lot of things that not everyone wants the exact same version. Everyone wants something slightly different. And we see this in sort of rapid prototyping and the development of all these do-it-yourself fabrication kits. And this is sort of where I think I see programmable matter fitting in. And as I said, in also in applications such as space travel, where you really can't predict ahead of time what you're going to need and develop fabrication processes tailored to one specific design.
Yeah, I can see that happening. Okay, Jonas and Mike, thanks a lot for being here with us on Robots.
Great, thanks a lot. It was our pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for being.
That's it for today's episode of Robots. For more information on our guests, have a look at our website at www.robotspodcast.com.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Flow with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.